Welcome to Conversations with David Lewis. Today, the unpleasant history of Forsyth County. My guest is Patrick Phillips. He's an academic and an author, and he's written a new book called Blood at the Root, A Racial Cleansing in America. Patrick is from Forsyth County, Cumming, Georgia, and he's written about a really dark history in that county. Let's cut to the headline, Patrick. What happened in Forsyth County in 1912?
In 1912, there was an attack on a young woman named May Crow, who was an 18-year-old white woman, and she was found beaten and bloody in the woods just a few miles from the house where I grew up, along what is now Lake Lanier, what was then the Chattahoochee River. And in the wake of her attack, there were claims that this had been perpetrated by black men. Three young black men were arrested, and May Crow died of her injuries about 2 weeks later. And on the night of her funeral, there were the first waves of night riding and the first band.
What's night riding?
So in 1912, night riding meant bands of white men, often mounted on horseback, rode out to the black communities, which were largely poor sharecroppers, not exclusively, but a lot of poor sharecroppers in the county at the time. And they rode out to these areas of the county, used arson, dynamite, shotguns into cabins, and basically issued an ultimatum that all of the black residents of the county had to be out within the next 24 hours.
And what happened?
Well, over the course of September and October of 1912, there are lots of newspaper reports that this kind of wave of terror went on for those 2 months and on into the winter of the early 1913. And by the end of about February, the entire black population of the county had been run out, 1,098 people.
Had been run out of Forsyth County.
Yeah, what's unique about Forsyth is that this happened in a lot of places in the Jim Crow era. What's really unique about Forsyth is that when I was growing up there in the 70s and 80s, this purge was still in effect. The ban was still in effect. You know, I remember UPS drivers, truck drivers would not stop in the county. I talked to in writing the book, I talked to a lot of descendants of some of the families who were forced out. And those people were raised in the 70s and 80s not to ever enter the county, that it was at risk of their lives to go there. So this was a, you know, really an 80-year-long purge. It lasted an extraordinarily long time.
So talk to me about growing up there and what that was like and when you became conscious that perhaps things were not normal.
My parents moved to Forsyth in 1977. We had lived in Sandy Springs. And they moved up to the lake, like a lot of people. They were commuting to Atlanta. And I didn't really realize that there was anything unusual about it until I started talking to kids on the bus. And I noticed that they, you know, almost entirely use the N-word to refer to people of color. And there are a lot of racist jokes and a lot of racist slurs everywhere. And so I asked a kid on the bus, you know, there don't seem to be any black people around. Why is there so much hatred? Why is everybody so angry about this and seem to be so full of hate? And that's when I first heard this mythic kind of version of the story. And kids on the bus just said, you know, a long, long time ago, there was this girl who got raped and murdered by black men, and all the white people in the county banded together and drove them out.
I mean, it's irrelevant whether or not these particular men of color actually did this rape. Describe the trial such as it was.
Yeah, I think you're right. In some ways, it is irrelevant in that even if they had been guilty, this doesn't justify punishing, you know, 1,100 people for that. But even so, even with that said, it seems highly unlikely. I can't say with certainty that they were not guilty. But what I did learn about the trial is that, well, one of them, Rob Edwards, was never tried at all. A 24-year-old field hand named Rob Edwards was dragged from the Forsyth County Jail. He was beaten with crowbars. Someone put a noose around his neck, and this was with not just a small lynch party, but a really big mob, hundreds of people who joined in, dragged him around the town square. And this is the same town square where I went to the 4th of July parade, where I got my first baseball glove. So reading about this was kind of harrowing, realizing it was in the place that I knew very well. And he was dragged around the town square and then hung from a telephone pole. And hundreds of people joined in and fired shots into his corpse. So that was one of the three. The other two were a 16-year-old boy named Ernest Knox and his cousin, who was 18, named Oscar Daniel. And again, the newspaper headlines referred to them as fiendish black rapists and, you know, the perpetrators of this dastardly crime. But when I started looking into it, Ernest Knox was an orphan at 16, very poor kid. And, you know, in the photographs, these just look like boys. And they were tried in a one-day trial. The judge in the case was a guy named Newt Morris, who would go on to lynch Leo Frank in 1915. So Newt Morris was the ringleader of the notorious Leo Frank lynching in Marietta in 1915. He was the judge who presided over the trial of Knox and Daniel. The sheriff in the county would go on to found the Ku Klux Klan chapter in Forsyth in the 1920s. Two members of the jury were Klansmen, and a couple of the attorneys involved were also part of the Leo Frank lynching. So, you know, nothing about the trial viewed from 2016 seems to hold up as anything like justice.
Right. The hanging of the two boys was quite a spectacle.
It was. They were supposed to be hung in private. This was the order. This was Georgia state law that executions would be held in private. And so there was the sheriff of the county decided to hold the hanging, despite this order of privacy, in a big field. And I've been there. I've walked the ground. This is right off of the Cumming Square. And there's a field that's ringed by hillsides. And he decided to hold the hanging in the middle of this field. And the idea was that the whole town, everybody in the county really, could come and line the hillsides and watch this execution. And, you know, the judge then ordered that they build a blind. But the night before the hanging, the fence around the gallows that was supposed to shield it was burned down. And the papers make the point that the fence was burned to the ground, but the gallows was left completely untouched. So, you know, not much question what the point was. And then, indeed, their hanging was described as a festival atmosphere. It was a kind of picnic day. Families came out with their children and spread blankets and spread out picnics and all, you know, really celebrated this double hanging.
What happened to the 1,100 people who, and you said most of them were sharecroppers, but some of them were landowners and businessmen. What happened to them?
Yeah, that was one of the things that really drove my research the most. They had always been this vanished vanished civilization in a way. So I'd heard this story, and even as a young kid, I remember wondering what happened to them, where they went. And so a lot of my research involved tracking down some of the descendants of these families and talking to them about family stories because, you know, poor people, sharecroppers, people who didn't own a lot of property, don't leave a lot of written traces. So the archives were kind of inherently biased towards the white side of the story. And I was able to recover some of that by talking and gathering these family stories. And what emerged was that a lot of them went just across the river. I found many of these families in Hall County, right across the river. Some of them came to places like Alpharetta, to Atlanta. And then others, there's a woman, Jane Daniel, who was also, she was the sister of Oscar Daniel, and she barely escaped alive from all of this. And she went all the way north to Detroit. I followed her in the Great Migration to Detroit. And then in terms of your other question, I did discover, I had always imagined a really monolithic black community, that they were all poor, that they all owned very little. And I think in hindsight that part of the story that I heard as a kid was meant to really almost justify it, to say, well, they didn't have very much anyway, so it wasn't as big a deal as it sounds because they were marginal. Instead, I found there was a guy named Joseph Kellogg who owned 200 acres. I followed him accumulating this land from he was freed as a young man. He was a slave until he was 21. He was freed, and he accumulates this land over the course of decades just by plowing the profits from one good harvest after another into buying more and better land and making shrewd deals. So he was the largest property owner, but there were other people who owned, you know, 160 acres, 80 acres, and they were, I had imagined them as very marginal, but they included educated clergymen, tradesmen, school teachers, you know, people who were really deeply enmeshed in the social fabric of the county.
And what happened to their land and so on?
That's a really fraught question. In 1987, the Georgia governor at the time was Joe Frank Harris, and he actually appointed a committee. It was called the Forsyth County Biracial Committee to look into this question. And a really telling thing is that committee, at the end of 10 months of work, six of the members were local Forsyth business leaders and community leaders. The other six were largely African-American leaders from Atlanta, from the King Center in Atlanta. There was a rabbi from the temple in Atlanta. So there were civil rights leaders from Atlanta.
Alvin Sugarman.
That's right. Exactly right, Alvin Sugarman. So there were civil rights leaders on one side, mostly African-American, but also Alvin Sugarman, and then white leaders on the other. And after 10 months of work, they issued two separate reports. There was really a white report and a black report to the governor. The white report claimed that there was no evidence of any land theft, that there was no
they said that the people of Forsyth owed no one an apology. They didn't owe anyone anything. And it was really, the report is kind of jaw-droppingly defiant in its denials. It said that the black, many of the black residents of Forsyth, quote, voluntarily relocated.
Yeah, voluntary with a gun at their head.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, then the land question was dropped, you know, it didn't go anywhere. But in looking at it later, and, you know, I was also building on the work of a journalist named Elliot Jaspin, who wrote about this in a book called Buried in the Bitter Waters. And I looked at all the same records Jaspin did, and what they show is that there were people who sold early, often for a fraction of what they had paid for their land, because you're not exactly in a position to negotiate. There were people who held on and tried to wait it out, who sold later, like 1914, 1915, because they were still hoping to come back. And then the third group is the most troubling, which is people who simply walked away. There's no record anywhere of any sale. There's no transaction at all. And then things are silent. And then at some point in the teens or the 20s, or sometimes even later, those land lot numbers reappear in other transactions.
And so there've never been any lawsuits of people to recover land or, those of statute of limitations or
exactly.
Whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Statute of limitations. A lot of these deals exploited an idea called adverse possession, which is common law in a lot of places and in Georgia. And it says that you can make use of abandoned land. So at the time, some of these transactions got the blessing of the state. But in hindsight, we can see that a great injustice was done. Normal legal mechanisms make it very, very difficult because of the time that's passed to remedy this. So this is maybe a prime example of the reason that, you know, there are people like Ta-Nehisi Coates calling for reparations and calling for federal reparations hearings. And this is an example. There's no way to remedy this by normal legal means. It would require a mechanism be created for this kind of situation.
Right. Tomorrow we'll continue my conversation with Patrick Phillips about his new book, Blood at the Root: A Racial Cleansing in America.